From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible because of you, our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, and some of you have, thank you so much. We are grateful. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Congress needs to pass legislation this year to finally secure protection for dreamers. And permanent protection for immigrants who are here on temporary protective status who came from countries beset by man-made and natural-made violence and disaster.
On Wednesday, President Joe Biden reviewed the first 100 days of his administration in a joint address to Congress, while also aggressively addressing the pandemic and its economic devastation. The promise of reversing the previous administration's draconian anti-immigration policies is underway to being kept. A sign of that was the news last month that the last undocumented person in North Carolina living in church-provided sanctuary was finally going home after four very long years. On this week's show, you'll hear from the Reverend Randall Keeney, vicar of St. Barnabas Episcopal Church.
Sadly, there have been attacks on religious worshipers and houses of worship in the news recently. More and more houses of worship are considering their options when it comes to security.
What a sad state of affairs. The growing number of hate attacks on vulnerable communities in this country includes threats and assaults on houses of worship. At least steps are being taken to defend those gatherings and facilities in some parts of the country. And later in the hour, I'll speak with Rabbi Robert Kaplan, a leader with the new Interfaith Security Council in New York City. But first,
today is a day of reason.
But today, Gene, is also National Day of Prayer. And some are saying that is not a coincidence.
This coming Thursday is designated the National Day of Prayer, an uncomfortably exclusionary and increasingly sectarian elevation of one set of beliefs over all others. While questions of constitutionality are discussed and analyzed, there are initiatives to model a different approach to the noble potential of the original declaration of this observance in 1952. One example is the designation of May 6th as a National Day of Reason, in place since 2003, which the Secular Student Alliance will observe by focusing on impactful community service and action. For details, I'm happy to be joined by Alliance Executive Director Kevin Bowling. Kevin, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here, and thank you for having me.
For those who are unfamiliar with it, talk a little bit about what the Secular Student Alliance is and what it does.
Happy to. So the Secular Student Alliance is a national educational nonprofit. And so the organization itself supports local chapters of students on college campuses, high schools, and even more and more middle schools, of students who are non-religious. And so we help them with their, one, find a group of friends, help them build their secular identity. And then a big part of this is developing community. And also then looking at sort of what activism that they're going to transpire the rest of their life. So we want to be proud of who they are, to form a great network, and then you need to dedicate your life to being active and making this world a better place for you, not only for yourself, but also others before you leave.
How long has this organization been around?
We actually just celebrated our 20th anniversary last year, so 2020. Not the best years to celebrate it, but we were happy to have the 21 years. I said, we're 21 now. We're finally legal. So it's great. But we have about 300 chapters all across the United States. The majority of those are in colleges and universities. And they do a variety of programming all, you know, across the United States. And so the National Day of Reason and May Day for Humanity is one program of many that we're involved in and our student chapters are involved in.
You're actually talking with someone who has put a lot of his life on the line in trying to help people understand why we're not supporting the National Day of Prayer and what goes along with that. And so I want to ask you, what troubles you the most about the way the National Day of Prayer has evolved over all these years?
Well, I think the main thing that you look at, I mean, we are really a secular nation. And so we have our freedoms, enshrined in the First Amendment of freedom of speech, and of course, freedom of religion, but also from religion. So, you know, everyone is prescribed to be able to practice their own religion personally. But also, if you don't want to, then you don't have to, and you have that freedom as well. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the biggest things is there's an assumption with the National Day of Prayer that, one, all Americans pray. And I think what we've seen, especially over the last 4 years, is this nod to Christian nationalism and that we're all Christian and we all pray. So, and if you look at the demographics of the United States, we continue to get more and more and more diverse. So, and that includes ethnic and racial identities as well as religious populations within the United States. But if you really look at the non-religious population in the United States, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that 1 in 4 of U.S. Americans identified as non-religious. So, 1 in 5. Now it's 1 in 4. But if you look at youth, and so I used to say 2 years ago, I used to say it's 1 in 3. But the new data that's coming out that's saying it's almost 50% of youth are identifying as non-religious. So if you just look at the National Day of Prayer, the amount of people, and especially youth who we work with on a regular basis, who that excludes, it's more and more. And, I think we've had a lot of division in the United States, and it really feels a lot better if we start coming together and working together to make our communities better, do things that are helping all of us as U.S. citizens, and really exemplifying those civic secular values that our nation was founded on and built on.
So talk about why you believe it's so important to offer a positive, uniting model for the first Thursday in May.
Well, I think we're doing an event, which May Day for Humanity, which is a 3-hour virtual, telethon, if you will, with entertainment and singers and comedians and those sort of things to raise money for people who have been affected by homelessness and hunger. And especially over this, with the pandemic and over the last year, I think it is hard to miss the impact that this has had on people. Even in the United States, 80 million people experience hunger, and 17 million of those were children over just the last year. And everyone's seen the food lines and those sorts of, the impact that COVID has had on the population, and especially communities of color, marginalized communities, and poorer communities have been the most impacted by that. So we really wanted to take a stand in doing something where we could, one, have some entertainment. I think after this last year, we could all use a good laugh, some great songs, some, you know, rousing speeches from people that we know. But also then to be able to donate and give back and really help local communities, homeless shelters and food banks in local communities to do better in their communities and help people. This is also a larger impact. So we have the Secular Week of Action. So this is one event in that entire larger week of things. So and it's sort of a counterpoint. We look at there's the National Day of Prayer. And so for the secular community, fine. You know, we don't think praying does a lot as far as actionable items that help people tangibly. So we'd rather get out there and do a week of community service where people are expressing and putting into action to help people in their local communities. And so it's one event on Thursday, but really it's part of a larger week of events for the Secular Week of Action.
Now, I'm assuming that the National Day of Reason is open to all Americans, even those who hold religious beliefs as well.
Of course. So I think the Secular Student Alliance, we do a lot of interfaith work. Our students do a lot of interfaith work. We partner with other interfaith organizations. So definitely. But I think in a real is if the basis of American society is a secular society.
Yeah.
And so when we look at the Secular Week of Action, everyone's invited. And of course, you know, the National Day of Reason, if I think we all support rational thought, we all support critical thinking, we all support the belief in science and making our world a better place. And on top of that, we're laying, okay, community service and volunteerism and making a community a better place. Everyone can participate in that.
You know, I probably shouldn't say this, but it should be that way at the Day of Prayer as well, but it is not, because not everybody is welcome there unless they fit into certain things that people expect from them. You are an action-oriented group. Has the COVID, how has that impacted you? Has it hurt you, or how have you dealt with that?
One of the things that we experienced, and really more our students experienced, is when their universities and colleges closed, they then lost their community that they had on that campus. And so, and in that local community. So many of our students went home. And we know that about 80% of our students come from religious families. Mm-hmm. So they went back home to non-supportive families and communities where religious students, and thankfully, when they left that community, they went back to their homes and their communities, which were religious and supporting. So keeping that connection going over this past year virtually has been extremely important to us. Our staff has put a lot of effort and time into connecting with educational and cultural and just and fun social things to do. So, and we, about 84% of our chapters have remained active across the country. And of course, most of that virtually. We have, do have a few students who are on campuses. And fortunately, you know, with everyone has experienced their Zoom fatigue, but we've offered a wide variety of programming, virtually. And we even have our national conference coming up on May 15th and 16th, which everyone is invited to, and is 2 days of virtual programs that everyone can participate in.
What do we need to know about that conference? And also, how can our listeners learn more about the Secular Student Alliance?
The easiest thing to do is go to our website at secularstudents.org. So there's, if you're interested in finding out where our chapters are, learning more about our values, our mission, the conference, it's all right there. We actually will be announcing our annual scholarship program at our conference and opening that up. So there's currently a link on our page for our scholarships for secular activism. That can be separation of church and state. That just doesn't have to be non-religious. And we have religious students who apply every year for scholarships as well. So the application form will come available during our conference. The easiest place is our website, secularstudents.org. And our conference, as I said, is May 15th and 16th. And a large lineup of speakers on a variety of topics. And we even have some videos that we recorded earlier that are on demand. And so one of those happens to be a very interfaith-based interview and discussion. So there's a lot there, but I think a lot that people would be interested in participating in.
There are, as you know, really serious challenges secular young people are facing in many parts of this country right now. I wish before you go, you would talk about some of those challenges and the kind of support that SSA offers, if you would.
I'm happy to. And yes, your statement is very true. And some of the recent research out and look at perspectives of how Americans see different groups within the United States. Non-religious or atheist is one of the most mistrusted groups in the United States. And that's unfortunate. So, and I think a lot of that comes from the stereotypes, that have come from the past. But if you go to our website and you look at all the things the values that we stand for and the impact that our students are doing, and I think the Secular Week of Action and May Day for Humanity are great examples of those things, you can see the impact that we're trying to have. And a little bit of our philosophy is we've got one life, and so let's make the best of it, and let's make sure that we leave this world a better place for others before we go. But I think we often hear of stories that our students are experiencing. And over the last few years, we've seen an increase in harassment and animus towards our students in the college university setting. And unfortunately, oftentimes those are from more conservative Christian students, which is unfortunate. We have great relationships with religious campus groups as well, though. The American Atheist recently did a study, the Secular Survey, and really looked at a large percentage of the population of the United States. And last year we co-released their Secular Youth Report with them, which shows how there's increases in discrimination, harassment, rejection from family members and community, especially religious communities, and the impact that's having on students on depression and self-worth and value and those sorts of things. The survey also shows when they get involved with an organization like the Secular Student Alliance, how that undoes a lot of that. So we're very happy of that. Mm-hmm. And just, I think one quick story is, we had a student last year, we have Ask an Atheist Day. So we celebrate twice a year. And so he did one post on his social media. And it's a day where, like, ask questions. Like, what do you want to know about atheists? Let's dispel the rumors and the myths and the stereotypes. And just, it could be fun questions. It could be serious questions. It could be religious questions, whatever you want it to be. And he did one post and his parents saw it. And they called them up and said, you need to disown this, foolishness. And he said, no, I don't believe in a God. And this is really, this is really how I see my life. So they disowned him. So cut him off financially, just right then and there. And so he relayed to us, he goes, I've got to go out and I'm bound and determined to continue my education. So fortunately this semester is already paid for, but they're not paying for any more. They're not helping me with any expenses. So he goes, I'm going out to get a second job because I'm staying through and getting my degree. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we hear stories like that all the time. Mm-hmm. And even, a lesbian student in Tennessee, and she said, it was way easier to come out to my parents as a lesbian. When I told him that I didn't believe in God, she goes, that was way more difficult. Yeah. So we continue, unfortunately, to hear these stories. And again, animus and harassment and rejection is unfortunately been increasing, even though almost 50% of young people now are non-religious. And this could be this current generation could be the first generation that goes from majority religious to majority non-religious.
Right. Yeah. Kevin Bowling is Executive Director of the Secular Student Alliance, empowering secular students to proudly express their identity, build welcoming communities, promote secular values, and set a course for lifelong activism. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I appreciate it, and thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Leaving Sanctuary at Last with the Reverend Randall Keeney. And later, the launch of an Interfaith Security Council in New York. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. On April 20th, the last undocumented person who had been living in sanctuary in a church building in North Carolina went home at last. It had been a long 4 years for Juana Tober Ortega, who was also the first such case in that state. Joining me right now is the vicar of St. Barnabas Episcopal Church, which sheltered her for all of this time, the Reverend Randall Keeney. Randall, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
What a powerful journey this must have been for you and your small congregation. How did you first get involved in the sanctuary movement?
Well, we had developed a relationship with a young man and his family from El Salvador and had considered offering him sanctuary. But as his wife and child had the opportunity to apply for asylum, so he chose to be publicly supportive of them and testify in court on their behalf. And as soon as he did, he was, of course, detained by ICE and spent about 2 years in detention. But his wife and son received asylum. So he didn't end up needing sanctuary. But we continued a relationship with a Quaker social justice group called the American Friends Service Committee. Mm-hmm. And they became aware of Juana and her plight, and they brought her to our attention.
What networks did you engage with in doing this work, either within your denomination or an interfaith basis? What was going on? How were you doing it?
Well, in the beginning, we were sort of on our own because it wasn't being done, in North Carolina, at least. So we were pretty much on our own trying to discern what we should do. After Juana was in sanctuary, other groups came to be supportive. The North Carolina Council of Churches has been wonderful in their support of not only Juana, but others that were in sanctuary in North Carolina. Of course, the American Friends Service Committee continued to be supportive of her and her presence in sanctuary after she came. And luckily there were folks on the League of Women Voters who ended up forming an immigration subcommittee that began to be very supportive of her and our work with her.
Randall, what do we need to know about Juana and the years that she spent in your sanctuary?
Well, Juana, and using this word in its best and deepest way, is a profoundly graceful woman. She's highly aware of her God, of God and her relationship with God. She was and remained a central member of of a Pentecostal church in Asheboro, and her faith has been a part of her life since she was a child. In fact, she would tell you that her faith and God are what got her through all of these things. She's also extremely strong. While at the same time being very humble. There's a quiet strength about Juana that that inspired all of us. Juana was the mother of two in Guatemala when rebels came to their village and demanded that she join their group and help them in their work and come out into the jungle and live with them. And she had two daughters, and it was made known to her that if she did not come, that they would kill her. So her parents basically packed her up and sent her to the United States. And they cared for her two daughters. And Juana came here and tried to build a life so she could eventually bring her children here, which she was able to do. And they eventually became DACA recipients. Then she married and continued her family and had two more children and grandchildren, and was working and paying taxes and reporting to ICE on a yearly basis. It's just that in, I think, April of 2017, when she reported to the ICE office, they put an ankle monitor on her and told her she had 30 days to leave the country. So that led her to seek help and refuge. Sure.
How did this ordeal affect her family?
Oh, my goodness. Just the loss of her presence in the household on a daily basis. The ability to, you know, hug your children, say their prayers at night, talk with them about their struggles at school, you know, in a more natural, regular way. You know, they're, you know, the supporting them and the building up of their families and search out of their careers and vocations. They came to see her quite a bit, but it's not the same as being in your own home and being able to sit around your kitchen table and talk about it and to talk about these things with your family.
How did this impact your congregation?
Well, for the overwhelming majority of the congregation, I would say 90%. Juana basically enfleshed the call in scripture to welcome the alien, to offer respite and hospitality to those that are in need. About, 10% or so of people really struggled with it politically, and we lost two or three families over it. We're small, so two or three families is 10% of us. So the congregation jumped right in and began, you know, staying with her 24 hours a day to make sure that if ICE came, she did not have to answer the door herself. We had emergency contacts and procedures in place in case immigration came to try to arrest her. And for at least until the COVID outbreak really kicked in, our folks plus other volunteers in the community were here with her 24 hours a day.
Well, I was going to ask you that because I wondered beyond the congregation if the community itself got involved in helping Juana.
Yeah, they did. We had people from several places, from the Quakers here in Greensboro, which is a large, wonderful group of people.
We had people from the Roman Catholic Church just up the road that were coming. We had people sending food and trying to take care of her. Food was something Juana really didn't need because she can cook like, oh my goodness, it's amazing. Our own diocese, the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina, was extremely supportive financially and prayerfully and otherwise. There was a UCC church here in Greensboro who took someone into sanctuary shortly after we did, and there was support there. So we did not lack for support.
Mm-hmm. Randall, what you just you alone? What did you learn from this experience?
One of the things I suppose is that if you're willing to go out on a limb and you have good reasons, good foundation, good theological, social, and justice and issues around justice supporting it, and you can articulate that, and then it's personified by someone like Juana, a human being, where immigration is not just an issue, or something is not just an issue, it's personified, mm-hmm. then people will begin to understand the struggles that certain communities and groups of people go through. Mm-hmm. It's sort of those personal relationships that eyes are opened and people begin to see the profound suffering of groups of people and the individual persons within those groups.
Mm-hmm. As you well know, a lot of activists are concerned that immigration policy is not being legislated, but is instead being enacted by executive order. Are you engaged in longer term activism around this issue?
I have been in the past. The sanctuary and things around it have sort of sort of occupied time. So I haven't been, and particularly over the last year or so with the COVID crisis, I haven't been as involved with the groups that are out there doing social mm-hmm. justice work as I would like to be, mm-hmm. but will be again in the future. It's disheartening, frustrating, and on occasion gut-wrenching. To watch our elected officials avoid this issue and refuse mm-hmm. to engage it and continue to use immigrants as political footballs and straw men and the other that they can, vilify. Mm-hmm. So it is profoundly frustrating.
I'm sure.
To watch the gyrations and contortions that some politicians will go through to avoid really doing something about the tragedy that is the American immigration system.
Randall, what would you want every American of goodwill to know about the toll exclusionary policies take on families and on communities as a whole?
Well, it goes from the most extreme, families burying their members because they can't immigrate, and hunger, disease, violence, civil war ends up taking their very lives. before they can, you know, because they cannot leave. The folks that die on the journey here because it has to be done, you know, it's so secretly and you know, and people end up trying to go through the desert to get here and starve or thirst to death. Mm-hmm. People dying in rivers. You know, and once they get here, the trauma of knowing that at any moment they could be detained and could be deported. Mm-hmm. Children are living with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, even traumatic distress disorder, mm-hmm. Where they can't sleep. They're afraid to go to school. Parents are afraid to work. They get pushed to the darker edges of our society and victimized by people. It's a profound suffering. You know, and the majority of folks that are in the United States, you know, without papers, which the United States used to welcome people and then provide their papers. Now we refuse to give them, quote, papers. Mm-hmm. The majority of the folks here are folks that overstayed their visas. Mm-hmm. But the folks that are suffering the most are those who are coming trying to escape violence and poverty. So it is a dark shadow covering entire families and individuals, children and adults. Mm-hmm.
The Reverend Randall Keeney is vicar at St. Barnabas Episcopal Church in Greensboro, North Carolina. After being the first church to offer sanctuary to an undocumented immigrant threatened with deportation 4 years ago, the congregation was the last to see that same person finally leave the building earlier this month, the last such resident in the state to do so. Randall, I so admire what you have done and what you have shared with us. I'm so grateful for your sharing this experience, this message, this teaching. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. And I thank you for your work and for carrying, being willing to bring these messages to people's attention. Keep it up.
The story of assaults on faith communities, often Jewish synagogues, but certainly not always, are chilling. While not usually as extreme as the story of members of a synagogue hiding in Charlottesville, Virginia, while armed supremacists mulled around just outside during the Unite the Right rally a couple of years ago, hate attacks are growing both in number and intensity. So it is, sadly, no surprise that an initiative called the Interfaith Security Council has been founded in New York City. With details, I'm joined now by Rabbi Bob Kaplan. Bob, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here with you.
Well, we're honored to have you. Who makes up the Interfaith Security Council at this point?
It is a partnership between about 37 different faith groups in New York. When I say faith groups, those are groups with constituencies, Catholic Church, the New York Council of Churches, various different Muslim groups, there are Buddhist groups, Hindu groups like the main temple here in New York. New York's an incredibly diverse faith community. Yeah. We've gone way beyond the old Abrahamic paradigm, and it's important to recognize that and have people at the table. So, however, the organizers are something called CSS, the Community Security Service. It is a group that has been working with synagogues throughout the nation. There are similar type of groups internationally as well that find volunteers, train them to be part of the security teams that work in synagogues on a regular basis on the Sabbath, on the Shabbat, on the various different holidays and otherwise. Another organizer is the CSI, Community Security Initiative. It was founded by both JCRC, Jewish Community Relations Council of New York, where I work, and UJA Federation shortly after the events in Poway and Pittsburgh, as fear and anxiety was rampant throughout the community. It brings in some top-notch professional folks to come into synagogues, to come into Jewish organizations, and help them to assess the security needs, write the Homeland Security grants, really provide the kind of consultation that you really need. You can get from the NYPD here in New York, incredible consultation, but it is very focused on the Jewish community, very specific. And something called the God Squad, the 67 Precinct Clergy Council. It is an effort, an incredible effort in Central Brooklyn that brings together faith leaders throughout the Central Brooklyn area with the various different law enforcement folks to meet the challenge and has met the challenge of gun violence. So what we saw from the work from CSI, from CSS, UJA Federation, of course, JCRC, and the God Squad, was there was a deep level of expertise. And it also brought a lot more folks into the houses of worship when they can come, but it also helped people to feel a little bit more secure. Mm-hmm. So we felt it was important to bring together all the faith groups in New York to really talk about best practices, expertise, what resources were out there, what resources needed to be out there, and with the rise in particularly in anti-Asian hate in New York, how we can bring in other folks to be part of this work together. It may sound a little corny, but we really do believe in this notion of stronger together. When we have a shared society in New York, we can have, you know, hate being seen as unacceptable rather than it rising up and challenging us all.
What prompted the founding of this group? Was there a tipping point?
So obviously we've seen a rise in hate across our nation. In New York, just prior to the pandemic, there was a rampant and a very scary rise in anti-Semitic attacks. Certainly, the issues that happened in Poway and Charleston and what you mentioned before in Charlottesville, for some reason, and I'm not going to become political, I work for a nonpartisan organization, hate has become acceptable again. Yeah. And while I'm not Pollyannish at all, I don't think we'll ever get rid of it. I think that we have been successful in the past of pushing it into the recesses, of making sure that people thought it was unacceptable. If they wanted to act out on it, some still did, but less did because they thought that, well, they would just be derided and seen as a pariah within the context of our society. Well, that sort of got pushed aside for a while. And we need to be able to do that in a very thoughtful, in a very, very strong way. And the faith community needs to be in the lead of that. Mm-hmm. We need to be ready. We need to step up and make sure that we're making that message loud and clear. So with the rise of hate, with the rise of these issues, and also with the rise of some really good organizations developing some real good expertise and seeing that it made a difference, we decided, well, this was the natural next step. Because we could all hunker down and make sure that we're safer in our own communities. But there's no real communities anymore. There are certain areas in New York that where people live. However, we're all sharing a society. And if we're going to truly share the society, we have to make sure that we find the opportunities. Held back a little bit by the fact that everything had to be done virtually and online. But, you know, we've learned to do that now. We've learned to connect. And we're just going to keep moving it forward.
You know, I was amazed not only by the size and breadth and diversity that you've brought together, but also with that, and you mentioned it, there's great expertise there as well. It'd be interesting to me if you just talked about some practical functions or some illustrations of how that expertise is used in day in and day out.
Sure. So, for instance, with CSI, some of the folks working there, some of my colleagues working in CSI over at JCRC are ex-police chiefs. Some of them are involved in other aspects of law enforcement. So they've been there and done that. They understand what you need to look for when you come to a house of worship. Lay people don't understand, well, this window or this door or this access or this egress could be problematic. They get it. They have expertise. They help us to focus on it. And what are the solutions? CSS has developed an incredible new program and around training, helping those volunteers, not just to become volunteers, but really better at what they do. And I'll give you an example. I know that myself and a friend of mine named Tamara Fish have been doing and just started launching within their curriculum a new series on unconscious bias and Jews of color. So that when folks show up at your house of worship, you know, it's not that you don't do your job. You know, we have to do our job. We have to be, you know, very conscious of security. But rather than operate on a limbic system of flight and fright when somebody shows up that doesn't look like you or act like you, it's switching off to critical thinking. So the fact that they've incorporated that into their training is amazing. And the 67 precinct clergy council, I can't begin to tell you, when you can bring together that many clergy to be trained and understand that their responsibility is, along with the police, along with society, is to lower gun violence and lower the rhetoric in communities, that's a level of expertise. It's hard to replicate. This is years in the cooking, so to speak. We have built coalitions in New York around quality of life for years. So when we had to reach out to all these various different faith leaders, well, it wasn't like we were making friends for the first time. We had done lots of different things in the past around healthcare, around education, around the issues that really are challenging our society. So they understood when they came together, this was not just going to be another, you know, optic meeting. This was going to be a meeting with real concrete next steps. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. Part of that meeting, by the way, I know rabbis like to talk. part of that meeting, by the way, was just hearing what their concerns are. Yeah. You know, my attitude in the Jewish community, in the white Jewish community, is seeing a police car in front of my synagogue goes, oh, look, my friends are here. They're out to help me. Isn't always exactly the reaction of other communities. So we have to become aware of that, and we have to become conscious of that and then respond to that as well.
It sounds like that the makeup that you have involves people that are not just saying, oh, yeah, we support that. There are people actually involved in doing what needs to be done.
Oh, absolutely. There are people that, again, who have expertise and people who have needs. When you put expertise together with needs, it's a really good combination. It makes a fine dish to serve for dinner. So I think that the beauty of what's happening here is that people not only are looking for help, they're not only looking for expertise to be brought to them, they're also looking for people to hear them and a way of articulating what their needs are and at the same time navigate all this stuff that's going on. We are a traumatized society without all this hate. You know, the pandemic just blew apart the faith community. We all have to figure out what it all looks like, you know, when we go back to whatever it looks like. So being together, working together, communicating with each other is key to that process.
What kind of cooperation are you experiencing with law enforcement and other community organizations?
So, it's a great question. at the first meeting, the first gathering, we had someone from the FBI, from the Civil Rights Unit, come in and talk about what the FBI is doing. NYPD is just really on target with this. They're connected to this. They work with us very closely, and we want to deepen those connections. Every aspect of law enforcement has been a helpmate to this process, because what we all need to understand is we all want to get to the other side of this. We all want to make our ultimate goal is to enjoy our lives, take care of our families, and make sure we're all safe. Well, the police need to do it in a certain way. Law enforcement needs to do it in a certain way, and the community needs to do it in a certain way. If we can sit and talk about how we blend those certain ways and we achieve each other's goals, well, it doesn't get nicer than that.
You know, this kind of organization is both sad and abundantly clear and a blessing in many ways. What kinds of best practices are members of the council sharing with each other?
Well, again, we're relatively new. We just kicked off a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. However, we're already beginning to share, well, what resources are out there? What are the Homeland Security grants? What do those mean? And what does it literally concretely mean, you know, in being able to have certain features that keep you safer? The other thing that we're sharing was an interesting conversation was our attitudes towards, you know, the fear that we're experiencing, that we're not alone in this process, that each and every faith group is sort of feeling the same thing. And by having the other stand up for you, it's really, really an important part of the process. Mm-hmm. We're also beginning to look at the issue of trauma and what has been the trauma and what is the faith community's role in meeting that challenge, both not only for our congregants, but for us. You know, this has really kicked us upside the head in a very defined way. And I don't think we've even begun to tackle or really begin to digest just how deep this trauma is, both, again, in our congregations, in our society, and certainly in us as well. So those are some of the areas we're sort of diving into.
Are there hopes for expanding this kind of cooperation to other cities and states? And how can people who are listening to this show, who will be interested in what you're doing, know more about what you're doing and even be supportive to it?
People tend to think, and I've heard this one more than once when I do this stuff internationally, we train and teach. Oh, that's New York. You guys can do that in New York. No, this is about people. This is about knowing how to reach out to connect to somebody. Sometimes in New York, things harder because it's just bigger, you know, and it's more complicated. It's more complex. It's more diverse. We've got probably the most diverse city in the world, you know, over 250 different language, ethnic, racial, faith, keep on going, groups that are just sharing communities all the time in some really challenging times. So, yes, I think that the model is adaptable and adoptable to anywhere because people need to be able to work together.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be able to say to each other, you know, I can do this with you, standing together. So if anyone's interested, they can certainly get in touch with us. You know, I'm available. It's at JCRC of New York. I think it's important that we do share.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that we've, by the way, that we've done through the Center for Community Leadership that I found and direct in New York has been replicated already. They're one of our youth programs called Youth Bridge, which has been around since 9/11, now has established itself in Munich. Or our adult fellowship for up-and-coming non-for-profit and faith-based leaders called We Are All New York has been reestablished in Sydney, Australia. People have adapted and adopted it to their context, and it's made a big difference in their lives.
Bob, did you ever anticipate as a rabbi that this would be such an urgent issue in the year 2021 in America?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I always talk about this. I had a great, great spiritual teacher. His name was Smokey the Bear. And Smokey taught us. I mean, so there he's little kid sitting in front of the TV. This cute little bear, big bear, comes in front of us and goes, only you can prevent forest fires. Well, he taught us a really powerful lesson. Forest fires happen. You know, they're going to happen. And the problem is that sometimes we cause them to happen. So it's easier to prevent something than to put it out, because then all the animals that were standing behind them, you know, they sort of get like, they lose their homes and they look scared and all that kind of stuff. Well, we have to be those leaders. We never know what's going to happen. No one would have predicted a 9/11. We should have. Perhaps we should have even predicted the pandemic we're going into, but we didn't. We have to be prepared to do this kind of stuff. Conflict has always been conflict resolution. My job in New York, and I've been doing this now for 27 years at the JCRC, is conflict prevention. So we need to be able to talk and work with our colleagues, friends, and sometimes the people we disagree with in society, how we can work together to ultimately have a better context for everyone. If we can do that, then we're going to be winners, mm-hmm. and we're not going to be losers. And we're going to be the folks that can make the American dream everything it needs to be. And as faith leaders, you ask me if a rabbi, that's God's little joke on me, you know, but as a faith leader, I got to do this. So I'll be like Mahatma Gandhi. I said, it's got to start with me, you know, and then I got to bring it out into the world. But yeah, it happens. And the question is, are we ready to meet the challenge when it steps in front of us?
Rabbi Bob Kaplan is founding director of the Center for Community Leadership at JCRC New York. He is among the concerned faith leaders who have just launched the Interfaith Security Council in New York City. Thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. You are welcome anytime.
Thank you so much for having me, and perhaps I'll take you up on that sometime in the future.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Remember, your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and in company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think State of Belief might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, well,